Good afternoon and welcome to House Labor and Commerce for Monday, February 5th. It is 3:15 p.m. Members present today are Representative Sullivan Leonard, Representative Knopp, Representative Birch, Representative Josephson, Vice Chair Wool, and myself, Chair Quito. We do have a quorum to conduct business. Please turn off your cell phones as we're conducting our meeting. If you need to take a phone call, you can take it outside of the committee room. Today, our support staff are Recording Secretary Susie Edwardson and our LIO moderator Leah Kraft. And we do have some bills that we will be opening up for public testimony. First bill on the agenda is House Bill 323, extending the Board of Pharmacy. And then we intend to bring up Senate Bill 64, adopting Uniform Environmental Covenants Act. And then we'll have a presentation from the Alaska State Home Builders Association regarding state residential building codes and a bill request. And I would like to note that at 3:16, we have been joined by Representative Stutes. So let's go ahead and bring House Bill 323 before us, extending the Board of Pharmacy. So we have Angela Steffel, or Representative Sullivan Leonard, will be presenting the bill directly. And so if you can place your name and affiliation on the record and provide your introductory statement. Thank you.
You bet. Thank you, Chairman Quito and committee members. For the record, I'm Representative Colleen Sullivan Leonard. I'm presenting today on House Bill 323, which is the extension of the Pharmacy Board from June 2018 to June 2022. Also with me today is Chris Curtis, which is State of Alaska Legislative Auditor. And then also I have Leif Holm, who's online, and he is the Pharmacy Board Chairman and also a member of the Pharmacy Association. Just a quick review of the sponsor statement, if I may. Mr. Chairman, Legislative Audit reviewed the board's operations, and they've determined that it is in the best interest of the state to extend this board, considering recent statutory changes, expanding the board's responsibilities in relation to the controlled substance database. Therefore, it is recommended to extend this board for 4 years. The Board of Pharmacy is comprised of 7 members, 5 pharmacists, and 2 general members of the public. March 2018, they will have full composition of this board. They meet 4 times yearly, and they're a very active board. Just a quick overview of what the board does, Mr. Chairman. The board regulates admission into the practice of pharmacy. They are within compliance with professional standards and adopting regulations. They establish and maintain the controlled substance prescription database, as well as vaccines, emergency medications, and the opioid overdose drugs. The board also oversees licensings for pharmacists, pharmacy interns, and then also pharmacy technicians, as well as pharmacies, wholesale drug distributors located inside the state, as well as registering of pharmacies that are located outside of the state that may be shipping medications here to the state for consumers here within the state of Alaska. That's pretty much it in a nutshell, Mr. Chairman. I have Chris Curtis, who, if she'll join me at the table here, can give an overview of what the audit showed for this past year.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Questions for the bill sponsor? Seeing none, we'll Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know as far as the board is concerned, you know, we've had some discussion with the PBMs here within the last week regarding the range of qualifications, capability, and the kind of services that a pharmacist can provide. Is the board, is that something that, it's something I'd be interested in, is how how you might be able to broaden that, but I don't know that this is particularly the forum for it, but I just wondered if you had any insight into that in your discussions with the board members.
Thank you. Through the chair, I have not then had that particular discussion with the board members, but we do have Leif Holm, who is online. Mr. Chairman, maybe he could address that particular question.
I think we will be bringing Mr. home up, so I think if
okay,
you
maybe he could address it at that time.
And then perhaps after our auditor, we have Mr. Holm come forward.
Okay. Or, thank you.
Weigh in.
Okay. Any other?
Thank you. I do think we're ready for our legislative auditor.
All right.
Ms. Curtis.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Curtis. And for the record, name and affiliation, and then provide us with your testimony, please.
Good afternoon. My name is Chris Curtis. I'm your state legislative auditor. Hopefully, you all have a copy of the Sunset Audit, and it is dated August 2017. We did conclude this board is serving the public's interest. It is licensing effectively. We found that the board was conducting their meetings in accordance with the laws, and they're also actively amending regulations to improve the industry. Information you may find helpful, page 9, is the schedule of licensing activities. You will see at the end of March 2017, they had 3,747 active licenses, and this is a 33% increase from the last 2009 sunset audit, so significant increase. The page 10 is the schedule of revenues and expenditures. At the end of FY17, the board had a surplus of just over $275,000. And management within DCBPL stated that they would be conducting a fee analysis at the end of 2017. And then the schedule of licensing fees is on page 11. So although we did find that this board is serving the public's interest, we are only recommending a four-year extension. And that is in recognition that their duties have been significantly expanded through changes associated with the Controlled Substance Prescription Database. Page 3 of the audit goes through, provides some information about the Controlled Substance Prescription Database. 2008 was the law that that created the database. It put that responsibility for implementing and developing it with the Board of Pharmacy. The statute also required dispensers of controlled substances to electronically submit information for each prescription dispensed. And the database collects this information, and it is supposed to allow pharmacists and practitioners to consult and review prior prescription history. And this is prior to their prescribing or dispensing controlled substances. Statutes also say that the database can be used to monitor prescribing practices and patterns, identify practitioners who prescribe controlled substances in an unlawful or unprofessional manner, identify individuals who may be abusing controlled substances, and identify individuals who present forgeries or otherwise false prescriptions to a pharmacy. So there were quite a few problems with the 2008 law, and these problems were very slow to be addressed. On page 4, we summarize some of the challenges into two areas. First, it is the completeness of the information. The statute did not provide a way for the board to ensure that all people that were required to submit were submitting information. No way to control for completeness. And additionally, the prescription, the regulations that they put in place at the time of this statute required monthly reporting, which is in no way timely enough to be useful. Further, the second area is the use of information. And the law did not require practitioners or pharmacists to consult the database prior to prescribing, so it was completely voluntary. And the board was advised by the Department of Law that information in the database could not be forwarded to a pharmacist or a practitioner because that would be considered an unlawful, an unsolicited report, and that would be illegal. So consequently, the board did not analyze the information in the database to identify unlawful patterns or use or practice. And so it was fairly ineffective from the time it was created. Recently, there has been some changes to the law to address these problems. Now prescribers and dispensers must register with the database, and the Board of Pharmacy may notify other occupational boards when one of their licensees registers. So that will allow a check for completeness and a check for noncompliance. Dispensers are now required to submit information into the database daily. Dispensers and practitioners are now required to check the database prior to dispensing or prescribing or administering medication, and there is some exclusions there. and the board may now provide unsolicited reports. So on page 12 of the report conclusions, we state that with these changes, the board is now empowered to help combat the abuse of controlled substances. And given that these changes were very recent, the audit was unable to analyze to what degree the board is going to use this new authority to serve the public's interest. However, we can say the DCBPL management does not believe that this board should be proactively analyzing data to meet public health objectives. Traditionally, that wouldn't be the role of an occupational board. Further, DCCED management stated that additional resources would be needed if the legislature intends for this board to analyze data and become proactive in helping enforce prescription drug laws. We do have two recommendations for operational improvements, beginning on page 14. We recommend that the DCBPL chief investigator work with the director to improve the timeliness of investigations. So in reviewing the investigations, there were 20 that were open for over 180 days during the audit period. We tested 13, found 6 of the 13 had unjustified periods of inactivity, and those periods ranged from 51 to 184 days. Periods of inactivity were due to the chief investigator having competing priorities, as that person was also the person responsible for overseeing the database. Rec number two, we recommend that the DCBPL director improve procedures to ensure licensing documentation is appropriately obtained and retained. We did test 25 facility licenses. We found 3 errors. In one case, a self-inspection report was not in the file, so it was either not obtained or it was not maintained. In one case, we found a background check report was not obtained. And in one case, we found a DCBPL staff, did not follow up when an application disclosed that a citation had been issued on their out-of-state license. Further, we tested 25 individual licenses. We found one pharmacy intern. Their application didn't show evidence that they had met the education requirement. So definitely some room for improvement in the documentation area. Responses to the audit begin on page 45. The governor's office agrees that the board does serve the public's interest and should be extended. They do not comment regarding the controlled substance prescription database. Department's responses on page 47. They agree with both recommendations. In regards to Rec 1, the department stated that they had implemented new procedures which should help address the timeliness of investigations. And Rec 2, the department stated that they did agree that additional quality checks were needed to ensure that the administrative record was complete. However, they did state that additional supervisory resources would be needed to help ensure they meet that standard. The department, the chair's response is on page 49, and the chair agrees with both recommendations.
Thank you, Ms. Curtis. And I do have kind of a follow-up question on something you had brought up earlier, and that's with regard to the situation we have. I'll ask it later. No. Go ahead. Do we have any other questions, Representative Knopp?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Chris, I'm kind of curious. So we initially passed that database law back in 08, and so I'm going to get the question here eventually. And so now we're into 18. Did we audit this board somewhere in between? What was the last audit frequency? Was it 4 years, 6 years, 8 years? And then is it going to be another 4 years before we know? Is it going to be 4 years before you do another audit? And is it going to be at that time we finally find out if this database is being administered as we intended or effective, is my question.
Representative Knopp, through the chair, we did the last sunset audit in 2009. So just after the law was passed, there would be no way to analyze it at that point. There is a timeline on 6 that helps take you through how long it took for certain things to happen. There is some new reporting requirements that are part of legislation. They've always been required to report to legislature certain status of certain things. So there is a reporting mechanism that they do report to the board, to the legislature, the status of the database.
Thank you. Follow-up?
But it will be 4 more years before you do a complete audit on this again. Is that correct? If we extend this today?
Through the chair, yes. We won't be back until 4 years from now, 2021, probably to do the work.
Thank you. Follow-up. Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question on last week we talked about PBMs a lot, and it kind of and part of that the pharmacists are kind of front row center on that, particularly small pharmacists, in that they're trying to operate a business, but they don't really have, as near as I can tell, they don't really have a way of being compensated other for the margin on the pills, hopefully a positive margin on the pills that they sell. And I guess it kind of begs a question. In some jurisdictions outside of Alaska, pharmacists have the ability to actually be paid. They're in their white coats behind the counter, and they actually have they're able to be paid for some level of medical support services. And is it appropriate to solicit from the Board of Pharmacy any sort of insight or recommendations from them as to betterment of the industry and their profession and their I'm not that familiar with the audit. I mean, just going, it seems like it's all about pills and prescriptions and opioids and everything else, but it seems like it kind of begs the larger question of does the Board of Pharmacy see, or are they asked if they see any sort of legislation that would be helpful in the advancement and preservation, if you will, of their profession? And through the chair, I just not that familiar with the audit process here.
Through the chair, this is a unique type of audit because the criteria we use is actually spelled out in statute. So we're given 11 criteria, and we audit using that 11 criteria. So we look at whether are they serving the public's interest, is there duplication of effort, that type of thing. So that wouldn't be something, unless we heard complaints at a board meeting or we heard that this is a topic or some type of news article came up, it wasn't on our radar. And frankly, I was fascinated by sitting through the hearing earlier to learn more about it, because I really don't know much about that whole process.
Follow up.
Yeah, thank you for that. And it's kind of a learning process for me as well. But I at some point in time, I'm going to be I personally will be interested in soliciting some feedback, if you will, from the Board of Pharmacy, who's duly appointed and certified and continued and presumably extended here with our action today. But I will be interested in procuring some engagement with them as to any recommendations they might see as we move forward that might be helpful for continuing certainly the very important pharmacy businesses that we see around the state. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any other questions for our legislative auditor? Seeing no other questions, thank you, Ms. Curtis. We do have Leif Holm with the Board of Pharmacy available. Mr. Holm, can you place your name and affiliation on the record and provide us with your testimony?
Leif Holm, Chair, Board of Pharmacy. And I'm here to answer any questions for anyone and to also state that obviously as a board we support the bill to extend the board. We're definitely a necessary component of Alaska's public safety with regard to health care. And with the, we have an ever-expanding and very complicated, evolving profession, and it's definitely necessary to regulate our profession, and we believe that that should be done by pharmacists as a board. We do accept the four-year expansion as it's understood that our duties are expanding even further, and with the changes to the PDMP that have happened, it's a necessary follow-up period sooner than later for everyone's best interests. So I'll take any questions beyond that.
Thank you. And Representative Birch, did you want to repeat your question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, Mr. Holm, thank you for being available and for your service on behalf of the Board of Pharmacy. I certainly am supportive of Representative Sullivan Leonard's proposal here and the board extension, but we have been engaged over the last week in some discussions about matters PBM, which is an acronym I wasn't entirely familiar with a month ago, and I guess one of the issues that came to light were that the means of compensation through insurance reimbursement and so forth for professional services that are provided by a pharmacist. And I understand that there are some jurisdictions where that is possible, in that type of environment, and it's not possible in Alaska. And I'm just kind of asking the question as to where would you turn to remedy that, and just to see if you, as the chairman of the Board of Pharmacy, might have some suggestions. Through the chair.
Yeah, through the chair. Thank you for the question. It's kind of a complicated question. And being on the board, we generally obviously try to stay away from matters of financial interest, especially myself having an independent business. I don't speak as a board member when I speak towards PBM legislation and auditing practices and everything else that goes along with that. I do know that there is active push for pharmacists to get provider status federally. And I believe as a state, we're pushing for that as well. So in that case, pharmacists would have a little bit more leverage to bill for their services. But, you know, that's more of a with my board hat off that I discuss those kind of issues to be real careful not to, you know, make decisions on the board that would have any financial impact to my business or other businesses. We try not to think about that as we're going forward. It's about patient safety.
Yep, understand. Thank you for your comments.
Well, thank you. We've got a question from Representative Knopp.
Mr. Holmes, thanks for being here. So I guess I'm something the auditor mentioned that kind of got my attention. So you guys are charged with maintaining that database, a new one, not so new anymore, but last year we passed some additional legislation. So I guess I'm curious, when I'm looking at the financial statement and I see that you have no full-time or part-time positions, so how are you guys able to spend the time to maintain or even put the database together, and how's that working out for you?
To the chair, it hasn't worked out very well, as we've seen. We haven't had the time. We haven't had the manpower. We've been actively trying to pursue a bill to license out-of-state wholesalers in the state, and with that, we've attached an executive administrator position, and we have not successfully been able to get that passed. We did recently with SB 74, a little over a year ago, maybe a year and a half ago, summer of 16, I believe. That bill was passed, which allowed for a position for the PDMD, as well as a board assistance. But with the juggernaut that is the PDMP and the amount of work that it's going to take, I think that position that was created with 74 is going to be solely focused on the administration of the PDMP and to help us do what we're supposed to do with it and oversee it the way it's supposed to be oversaw. And also with the new legislation that was passed last year, it's now that there's requirements that people use it and monitor it, I think we're going to see a lot more fruits from the PDMP. So all this has gotten us to where we are now today, but I think we're moving in a positive direction there.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Holman. In regard to that, so I think we had a comment from our legislative auditor about the appropriate role of the Board of Pharmacy and the concerns about trying to implement or oversee the pharmacy database. Do you have any thoughts or suggestions or issues from the board's perspective that the legislature might be able to work with to resolve that issue, or is that something that we should be considering as an issue that we need to look at?
Well, I think with the actions that have been taken and the steps that have been taken, like I said, they're all positive steps. And with our new position that was created with SB 74, we've just recently gotten that position filled. It took a very long time to fill that position. I think the grade, I don't really understand the grades of employment within the state very well, but they had to adjust the grade many times to try to get a qualified individual. But just recently we've gotten an individual, and we're already seeing a lot of movement with changes of the PDMP and how she's able to monitor that and fill the board in on information. And I can see already over the last 2 months things have been moving fast. We're getting a lot of correspondence regarding it. So I don't know that there's a lot of changes that need to be made. I think, again, that's why we're getting a four-year period rather than a longer one. I think I think it's going to start moving along fairly well.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Holm. Do we have any more questions for Mr. Holm? We also have the department representative, Ms. Sarah Chambers, available for questions for the department. Do we have any questions for the department? Seeing no questions, what I'll do is at 3:41 open up public testimony. I don't have anybody signed. Actually, I do have Mr. Holt, Vice Chair, Board of Pharmacy, signed up for public testimony. Mr. Holt, can you provide us with your testimony, please?
Good afternoon, Chair. My name is Rich Holt. I'm the Vice Chair of the Board of Pharmacy and also a licensed pharmacist in the state of Alaska. I've gone through and certainly concur with Chair Holmes' review of the legislative audit. It extensively goes through the process that has been undertaken for the controlled substance database, and it's quite extensive. And one of the things from one of the representative's questions that I would say in support of legislative support is, although the legislative audit goes through great detail on the controlled substance database, there's certainly much more processes and functions of the Board of Pharmacy in protecting the health and safety of public, licensing of individuals, and attending meetings to make sure that law exam questions are updated yearly, et cetera. In that the EA position that we currently have in House Bill 9 and SB 37, which was heard this morning in the Senate for SB 37, would be great fundamental factors that would assist the Board of Pharmacy in performing our function. And so any support or assistance in those regards would greatly improve the functionality and improve the outcome of the Board of Pharmacy. Thank you very much, and I'm available for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Holt. Do we have any questions for Mr. Holt? Thank you for your testimony. We will hold the bill over until a future meeting, so I'd like to thank everyone who's called in, sent letters in, and engaged on House Bill 323, and with that, we will set 323 aside. Move on to Senate Bill 64, Adopting Uniform Environmental Covenants Act. If we can have the sponsor staff come forward and reintroduce the bill for us, please, for the sponsor, Mr. Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of House Labor and Commerce. Thank you for hearing Senate Bill 64 today, the Uniform Environmental Covenants Act. I have Rachel Hanke with me, a staff member that's been carrying this bill, if we have additional questions. And I just give you a brief summary of what the bill does. One of the things we focus on in our office is streamlining and removing obstacles that inhibit business, commerce, or the transfer of property without reducing public health and safety considerations. Senate Bill 64 achieves that. In 2003, the Uniform Law Commission has created a Uniform Environmental Covenants Act to overcome inadequate common law rules. What it does is allows for the sale of property with use limitations to mitigate risk. And Alaska is only one of seven states that does not have an environmental covenant law. So the bill protects the buyers and sellers of contaminated property while allowing the fullest and best use of that property until the contamination reaches safe levels. The bill creates a legal mechanism to safely transfer contaminated property through an environmental covenant. So I'll give you an example. In our district, there's a piece of property on the river, beautiful piece of property, multiple acres, the Hinkle's own it. This is one of the reasons I took on this bill. For 20 years, they've been struggling. Just a section, a little piece of that property is contaminated, yet they've been tied up. And this bill would allow the specific risks of that particular minor portion of that property to be outlined, would travel with as a covenant with the deed, and it would open it up for sale and making it economically and functionally viable. Remember, this is completely voluntary. They can continue to use the institutional controls as they do today, but that doesn't travel as a covenant with the property. So if you think about what happened in Love Canal, where There was a severely contaminated piece of property. A school district bought the property. It was their waste pit was buried 25 feet down. The school district built a school and then sold some of the land to build a community. And no one had knowledge of the contamination because nothing traveled with it. And, of course, you know what happened. It was really the beginning of the Superfund program in the U.S., major contamination, major public safety and health impacts. So we believe this is the right mix. It provides transparency throughout the life of the property and provides assurances to buyers and sellers that risks will be safely mitigated and managed. Other states have helped transform blighted property into marketable assets. In some cases, it's been entire communities that have benefited from such legislation.
Well, thank you. We've got a question from Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Machiki, you said, you started off by saying that these would exist until contamination reaches safe levels. And so my question is, would remediation continue during the pendency of the covenant? Or, that is, would there be continuing efforts to make the land safer, or would it sort of be discontinued?
So it depends on the contamination. If it was contamination were inactive, rehabilitation was ongoing, the property could still be transferred. The sections that were not affected by the contamination could continue or become a new business entity, if you would. If the schedule would likely not be interrupted. If it's a contamination that was just going through the natural process of eventually half-lifing itself out of being, having an impact, then that could occur as well. This really doesn't affect the remediation efforts. It just allows the property to be transferred while highlighting that contamination exists. And the covenant also, this bill also provides a simple process for amending or removing covenants once there's no longer contamination on the site.
Okay, follow-up? Thank you. Follow-up?
You indicated that the seeking of a covenant is voluntary, but I'm looking at page 4, and admittedly I'm reading this not in perfect context, but it says, in addition to other conditions for the department's approval of an environmental covenant, the department may require a specified person who has an interest in the real property that is the subject of the environmental covenant to sign the environmental covenant. And I made a note to myself saying, what if they won't? What if they don't want to participate and they have an interest in the real property? Do you have any response to that?
Well, for that particular question, I'd rather defer to Kristen Ryan, who is online, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
We do have the department available, and we can bring them forward for invited testimony and then perhaps get into some more questions if we don't have any other questions for the bill sponsor at this time.
Just one last one.
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair. You mentioned Love Canal, and I remember being a kid and hearing about that. And it strikes me that that's an example where there would have been vast public notice. There certainly would have been wide notice in that county, I think it was near Buffalo, New York, of the harm being caused. And I guess one thing I don't see here, and it comes out in critiques from a couple law journals that were given to me, is that there's tons of talk in the bill, tons of it, of notice, but it's all for those who either are pursuing a real property interest or have that interest. I don't see any requirement for notice for the next door neighbor. Is that something the sponsor would be amenable to?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, the way that I see our legislative process is that you hope that folks have a sort of pure heart in improving legislation to deliver the best outcome for Alaskans. If there's something in the bill that you think can be improved that follows along the sort of intent of this legislation, I am amenable to improvements.
Thank you.
Any other questions? The bill sponsor, Representative Knopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator, thanks for being here, explaining your bill. And I'll have to apologize because it's either I'm really getting old or I wasn't here when this was heard last year because I don't recall it at all. And I just had a brief time to review it. So a couple brief questions, Mr. Chairman. So the example you cited earlier on the property that we're both familiar with, is a little bit of contamination a prohibition against selling any or all of it? I mean, you mentioned now it wasn't able to be sold because of that contamination. That's what this would do. But I didn't realize if you had a willing buyer that anything prohibited it from being sold right now. Is that?
Today, through the chair, Representative Knopp, today they can use institutional controls now because there's knowledge of the contamination on that particular site. Mm-hmm. They can use institutional controls through the DEC, and Ms. Ryan will also talk about that. What it doesn't allow is the protection of the buyer and the seller, that it will travel, the contamination will travel with the deed. So you could eventually end up with a sale where a future buyer does not have knowledge of that contamination. This keeps that from happening.
Okay, can I just follow up? So the environmental covenant specific report interest in real estate through a Department of Environmental Conservation database. So that database already exists. That's the environmental control you're talking about now. And so, Mr. Chairman, I asked this question of the senator because there's another piece of property out north that a longtime family has held and was contaminated by another. And I thought they had a letter that it was cleaned, and then still it wasn't. There were some problems with the DEC classifying it. And so I guess where I'm going with that question, Senator, is there anything in this bill when it's deemed to be clean that will insist that the environmental covenants goes away? Or is there any, will DEC be able to continue to dispute them findings? I think that's kind of what happened on this last issue I'm talking about, without mentioning names or properties. But
so this Representative Knopp, through the chair, this bill does not change the way that the DEC does business. Okay. What this bill does is allow a buyer to be a seller, first of all, to more easily transfer their property because it's recorded in a covenant, and for a buyer and future buyers to be knowledgeable about contamination. So if for a piece of property that has known contamination through several buyers, there will not be a surprise purchase of contaminated property. And the same way that contamination would be deemed as being remediated today is the way that it would happen in this bill.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Bull and then Representative Justin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Machicki, I do remember last year when you were here and the story about the piece of land in Soldotna, I believe, and I think I understand that situation when someone wants to sell the land. This way they sell it, they tell the buyer there's contamination, as long as you don't put something inappropriate like a playground or something, all's well and good, and as long as we keep moving to clean it up. What about a more commercial industrial site, say something on the North Slope that's a big drill site that maybe definitely has contamination, and maybe when the lifespan of the field is approaching and they know there's going to be a very expensive remediation, they want to sell it and pass it on to someone that maybe can't afford to clean it up. Has that scenario been worked through at all?
It has been, and it's been considered. If you remember, our only opposition was the federal government, who happens to control 51% of the active contaminated sites in Alaska, which is 1,148 of them. It allows us to put land use restrictions on the federal property for the same expectation that they have of all of us on cleaning up state property. So it works with industrial. Also works with federal.
Follow up. Thanks. Yeah. Obviously, had some quick numbers there, so you're ready for this one. And I don't have all the background on it. I just, you know, that situation was presented during the interim. But so if there was a transfer like that, obviously they're not going to put a daycare center or something up there. But if you want to continue an industrial or maybe even not, I mean, if it's a depleted field, what happens to it at that point? Does the responsibility for remediation go on to the next buyer or lessee or something like that?
So that's an agreement that would occur within the buyer and seller. It does not displace responsibility. It's really about a formal communication process for future buyers. So in some cases, and one example I give is, again, I hate to keep pointing to the property in Soldotna, but a total cleanup for that property in Soldotna today is not something that family can afford. However, it's an incredible site for a resort. And someone building a resort, a major resort in that piece of property, the cost of that total cleanup would be a minor proportion of the planned investment for that particular site. So that would be an agreement that can occur as part of the covenant as well. It certainly can be a side agreement that occurs just in the transfer of the property.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Justison.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, you talked about notice to the public, and I see on page 11 it says the department may maintain a registry that contains all environmental covenants. I mean, I assume that that part of the reason a purchaser would get notice is the covenant would run with the deed, so it would be sort of self-evident on the plat or the deed. But it seems like another way to give notice would be for the department to be required to have a site where everyone can see where these are. Do you have any thought about that?
I believe that'd be a question for Ms. Ryan. Okay. Certainly, if you were interested in purchasing a piece of property, a title search would clarify any covenants with that property. That's very difficult to avoid. I don't know if we need a redundant system or not, but the may being there would be a better question for Ms. Ryan.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions for the bill sponsor? Thank you, Senator Michicki. Would like to bring Kristen Ryan forward. So, Ms. Ryan, if you can place your name and affiliation on the record, it looks like we probably do have some questions for you.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Do you have anything to add to Senator Michicki's testimony?
Sure. Since the committee hasn't seen the bill for a while, why don't I give a brief overview? For the record, my name is Kristen Ryan. I'm the Director of Spill Prevention and Response for the State of Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. As Senator Michicki has stated, this bill, in our minds, is about communicating contamination that's been left on a property for a variety of reasons. The example that I like to give is a restaurant in Anchorage. It's a Subway restaurant now, but originally it was a car wash gas station. When they removed the gas station part of the car wash, they found fuel had leaked from the underground storage tanks. They removed most of it, but some of it had migrated over to a foundation on the property. And this is a good example of a situation where we would allow contamination to stay on the property. If it's stable, if it's impeding some structure that would make removing it extremely difficult, we can allow, and we don't see that it's migrating off-site, that it's stable, it's not impacting anybody's health, we would enter into a situation where we would do what we call institutional controls on the property, and we would make a note in our database, which Representative Josephson does exist, and you can go online right now and search our database of contaminated sites, and that's where our institutional controls currently reside. And you can find the restrictions we placed on this property. Unfortunately, the new buyer of the property was not aware of our database and its existence and the restrictions that had been placed on this property because they were not on the deed notice and did not run with the land when he purchased it. He removed the building, spread the dirt everywhere, and built a Subway restaurant. And now we have a bigger problem to contend with, or he has a bigger problem to contend with. Had he known about the contaminated dirt, he could have handled it in a very different way when he had the right equipment there. So that's that's just another more Anchorage-based example, but they happen all over the state where people purchase contaminated property without knowing it. They do things that make the contamination worse and cost them more money. Had they understood that there were institutional controls and they needed to operate within them, they could have avoided those expenses and the possible risks that they now may have caused. So there's a variety of situations in the state where we put those institutional controls on property. Another great example is utility corridors, the truck rollovers that occur on highways. Sometimes that fuel goes down under the roadbed. Rather than making DOT dig up the entire roadbed, if we've contained it, we know it's not migrating out of that ballast rock. We'll just note it a citation in our database and make sure that DOT is aware that if they ever do any repairs on the road in that section, they need to remove that ballast rock because it's contaminated. Or where there's utility lines running through, it's very difficult sometimes to remove soil around electricity lines or water and sewer lines. So those are other areas are often we will to set a control in place for later removal when the time is right. I'm trying to think if there's any other examples I can provide the committee. I guess I could be just open for questions. Oh, I know Representative Josephson had interest in notification. Right now, any neighbors would be notified if their property were impacted. I mean, obviously that would be a requirement that the responsible party go talk to the neighbor if their contamination was leaching off their property under their neighbor's property. They're responsible for addressing that. Other than that, we don't have a mandate. You have to go talk to your neighbors if you're not impacting their property, although I assume it would be noticed if there's heavy equipment and moving dirt around, and there would be some obvious signs things were happening. This legislation was initially proposed over 10 years ago to help with some of the other questions I heard about property that has had potentially an industrial use and there is contamination there, to get that property back into the market into a use that would be safe for it. So it does actually help the transition of property that has had probably heavy uses into useful life again as some other use that's safe. So an institutional control, for example, could be like has already been mentioned. You don't put a daycare there, but you can put a manufacturing plant there. Those sorts of guidelines help buyers feel more comfortable with the purchases they're making and that they're not going to be liable for any future problems if one should occur. So it's sort of a disclosure and a safety mechanism on all sides.
Thank you.
Stop there and be available for questions.
Thank you, Director Ryan. We do have a question for Representative Bull.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm going back to the industrial application, and maybe you can run me through what normally happens. So if I'm drilling up there and decide that certain areas no longer workable and I want to leave, what is the normal state of affairs? You know, what's the normal responsibility that happens now to a depleted industrial site, say a drill site on the North Slope, to someone who's using that area?
Representative Wohl, through the chair. So right now, the industrial sites on the North Slope have all, as part of their lease, that's state land, you know, that they're leasing. So they signed an agreement with the Department of Natural Resources that they would return it to its original state when they were done. So remediation is tied into their lease arrangement with DNR.
Follow up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess this, when we're talking about land sales, it doesn't really apply up there. And Senator Machicki used the example of a piece of property privately owned that maybe someone couldn't afford to remediate, but if they were to sell it to someone building a resort, suddenly the new buyer could afford to remediate it and remove the contamination. Could the opposite happen where the person, the leaseholder, whatever, could afford to remediate but then would later sell it to someone who couldn't afford it and therefore would be sort of not responsible and I guess it has to do with terms of lease or what the terms are there, but Is that something that conceivably could happen?
Ms. Ryan?
Representative, well, through the chair, not necessarily, and this bill wouldn't change our current legal process in those situations. If you have contaminated property, you're the if you contaminated the property, you're the responsible party. If we don't find out about it until future buyer is the purchaser, our laws do require us to initially approach the current owner. And the way our system is set up now, which, again, this bill does nothing to change, the current owner would then go after the person who caused the contamination in court. So the current mechanisms are still in place for pursuing the actual responsible party if for some reason you are the lucky owner now of something that you didn't cause.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Josephson, then Representative Birch.
Thank you, through the chair. Ms. Ryan, I guess fundamentally the question I have is I need to be disabused of the concern that that nothing in this law would stop the current process for remediation. It would simply ease the ability to alienate or transfer or move an asset with notice of the contamination from one person to another. Because a swift reading of this, I mean, a person in my position could be concerned that that regulators would just sort of throw in the towel and say, well, you know, nothing more to do here. Let's move on. And I understand that there comes a time when that has to happen as a practical matter. You gave the example of the gas station. But there's nothing about environmental covenants that would increase that decision point in your mind.
Representative Josephson, through the chair, absolutely not. This bill does not change our current environmental regulation paradigm. We have the same laws in place, and we'll, after this bill, if it passes, that require responsible parties to clean up contamination that's above our cleanup levels. All this bill does is provide a more thorough communication mechanism if for some reason we've made the decision it's okay to leave some of it in place. And I've given a couple of examples when and why we would do that. It's not our preference. We are, of course, the responsible party always has the option to clean it up. If they don't want a covenant, then they can clean it completely up. So it's not, it does not change how we would regulate contamination. It just gives us more assurance that future owners are aware of what they're purchasing.
Follow-up?
If you could, that was helpful. If you could explain through the chair, Ms. Ryan, the section called Notice of Activity and Use Limitation. It links itself to Environmental Response Project, which is part of CERCLA. And I'm just trying to, but then it allows the owner to sort of move from one to the other. And the Notice of Activity and Use Limitation seems to be, it certainly reads like someone who's more determined to remediate than does the other sections. Does that make sense? Can you explain in layman's terms what the Notice of Activity and Use Limitation is all about?
Yes, Representative Josephson, through the chair, and thank you for asking that question because it is very confusing and it's been a long time since we've talked about this. That entire section is to accommodate the federal government. We, as a state, are technically not allowed to put a covenant on federal property. And what has happened over the years, we're not the only state with this problem where there's a lot of contaminated federal property. Over the years, states have developed, Colorado in particular, this specific tool to put a notice of use restriction, which is the equivalent of a covenant, on federal property. So it's a covenant by all other names, but it kind of gets past the federal government's barrier that a state can't restrict the use of federal property. So that's the only intent of that section. It would allow us to do, as Senator Michiki has already mentioned, put covenants or use restriction on federal property. This is pretty critical to us, not only because we have a lot of federal land and a lot of contaminated federal land, but Native corporations in particular have inherited a lot of that contaminated federal land through ANCSA trades. And this bill would make communication of that contamination much more clearer than it was when that land has been transferred in the past, which has caused a lot of problems. So it's important for us to keep that in there so that we can make sure that federal contaminated land also has the same obligations to share with future purchasers or inheritors of property that there's some contamination remaining on it.
Ms. Ryan, this is Chair Keto. Can you maybe, as a matter of filling in a little bit, talk a little bit about the letters we've received from Department of Defense and then whether or not they are comfortable with this language assuaging their concerns?
Mr. Chairman, we've had many conversations with the Department of Defense, including up to about a month ago. So it has been an ongoing conversation. They still are uncomfortable with the concept that a state can put restrictions on federal property. Yet they are compliant with this exact language in the state of Colorado, as I've already mentioned. So we kind of agree to disagree. They're nervous about perhaps the state having some enforcement authority on federal property, and our arguments are that we have enforcement authority on federal property, and perhaps we'll have to, you know, resolve this legally at some point. But they also do recognize the need for it and want to find a way to communicate things going forward as well. I mean, these properties sometimes are transferred 100 years from now. I mean, none of us are going to be around when some of this contaminated property is transferred. I want to make sure that people know what happened, and this is really the only way to do that. So they don't have a better method. This is the best method that we're aware of, and we've researched it very heavily, and they're doing it. So I guess our response is that we disagree with them, and we do think this is the right method, and we want to proceed.
Thank you, Ms. Ryan. Do we have any other questions for Ms. Ryan? Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This looks like a great idea. I've had some experience in this arena, and I think the idea of having a having something that's actually recorded follows the property as long as there's a problem is great. What is the threshold today for a Superfund site? Is it it's a dollar? As I recall, is a dollar value, estimated value for the cleanup. And then, as I recall, the federal government kind of kicks in and moves everybody out and says, we'll take over here. But what is that dollar value? Through the chair.
Ms. Ryan.
Representative Birch is the chair. To get a site listed as a Superfund site is a whole process. There's really no dollar amount required, and it's really about risk and concern to the environment. The state of Alaska has not, that I can recall, I think we've only had two listed in our history as a state. It's not something that we as a state have thought was a good process. It's sort of a negative connotation associated with being a Superfund site.
It's terrible.
As you can imagine. And the state has pretty robust contaminated site land regulations. So historically, EPA has let us take the lead on most sites, and we work closely with them. But there's definitely places in our state that there's been conversations that they should be listed or not. The problem from our perspective is it takes us out of the driver's seat. It puts EPA in the driver's seat, and we would rather manage our land contaminated issues than EPA, unless there's a real significant reason we would rather have the federal government be managing that cleanup. So I don't know the specific dollar amount, but it does require the state to contribute financially. We're not off the hook financially if a site is listed. We have to pay for the ongoing monitoring going forward, so it's not necessarily the best thing from our perspective.
Thank you very much. I could not agree more. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and Representative Birch, I guess my recollection may be mistaken. It's been a while since I've dealt in that area, but it seemed to me that it would require an act of Congress to list a Superfund site. Thank you. Any other questions for Ms. Ryan? I don't see any other questions. Thank you for your testimony. At this time, 4:15 p.m., I would like to open up public testimony on Senate Bill 64. I don't have anybody signed up at this time, but is there anybody in the room or online that would like to testify on Senate Bill 64? Seeing so, but nobody in the room and hearing no one online, I will close public testimony at 4:15 p.m. And that brings the bill back before us. Is there any additional committee discussion on Senate Bill 64? Representative Josephson.
Is the chair, would the chair consider an amendment timely?
At this point, without having the chance to review it or the department to review it, I think an amendment can be offered, but I'm just not sure where we end up going with the amendment without the department having the ability to understand it. If the department does understand it, perhaps we can have that discussion. If you would like to offer your amendment,
sure,
we can have that discussion.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's one sentence. Public comment. Before the commissioner signs an environmental covenant, the department shall provide an opportunity for public comment on the environmental covenant.
And if we can bring the bill sponsor forward to address that, and then we'll also have the department weigh in. And it looks like we are talking about amendment number one. So you've moved amendment number one?
I'd love to. Amendment number one, yes.
Go ahead.
I move it.
And I will object for purposes of discussion and engagement. Senator Machicki.
Could you give me a page and line where you were thinking that might be inappropriate?
Yes, Senator. The Ledge Legal recommended page 3, following line 4. I'm not entirely sure why. It's not, I don't think it's a section that exists in the law now. So it would become a new 4604303. And it says, public comment. Before the commissioner signs an environmental covenant, the department shall provide an opportunity for public comment on the environmental covenant.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, this is a property owner's voluntary decision as to whether or not he or she places a covenant on their own property. I'm trying to understand the value in the public commenting on his private property decision.
Well, I mean, my response would be that we've seen that notice is not, although the director said there is some form of database, I believe. What the bill says is that the registry is optionally required at the department's discretion. And there's a lot of discussion of, I read this and I was almost concerned that somehow a person's right under Title IX to bring a civil action could be impacted. I think I was alarmist in thinking that. But I think that, you know, in my hometown of Anchorage, If a new public building is built within 500 feet, I get notice of it. I get notice of widened sidewalks. This strikes me as an opportunity for the public to know, indeed, there's an issue with that property, and to educate themselves about that fact. And I would say that those who I've invited to comment on this, and here I'm talking about the Alaska Community Action on Toxics, have said that there are notice concerns. They've recommended a couple law journals to me, the Ecology Law Quarterly and a Boston College article. They express concerns with notice. And if I may read just one part.
Representative Justice.
Okay. So I'm reading from the Uniform Environmental Covenants Act and Environmental Justice Perspective at page 1025. It's a 2004 edition. Early, ongoing, and meaningful public participation is the hallmark of sound public policy and decision-making. The community most directly impacted by a problem or project is inherently qualified to participate in the decision-making process. Mechanisms must be established to ensure their full participation, including training and support for community groups, technical assistance grants, community advisory groups, and others. This is from an article, again, on UECAs. And I am pleased that Director Ryan got to take up this and remind us of her testimony and this bill before, but it does strike me that these are sort of significant covenants that actually interrupt the normal common law. In fact, the bill says they do that. And I just think that notice is reasonable.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Machicki.
On page 3, I'm sorry, on page 5, the notice of environmental covenants beginning on line 8, if I may read, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Senator Machicki.
A copy of the environmental covenant shall be provided by the persons and in the manner required by the department to each person that signed the environmental covenant, 2, each person holding a recorded interest in the real property subject to the environmental covenant, 3, each person in possession of the real property subject to the environmental covenant, and 4, each municipality or other unit of local government in which real property subject to the environmental covenant is located, and 5, any other person the department requires. So the municipality is notified. I wonder if perhaps in order to meet your objective, the word may should be changed to shall in it being included in the database. And I would love to hear the director's comments on that suggestion, if that seems like it would meet your objectives.
Yeah, if I could,
Representative Josephson.
Can you explain where, what you're proposing?
Well, you pointed it out earlier, and I'm sort of looking, but it was the point where I'm sorry,
go ahead, Senator.
Yeah, I see.
You talked about the section that talked about the database. I just wonder if that may should be a shall, and that might satisfy your objectives without a burdensome and potentially costly action by the department to notify formally.
And Mr. Chairman, for the record, I think he's referring to line 29, page 11. The director talked about some other form of, I can't remember the word she used, of available notice, but that would, I think that would make some improvement to change may to shall, requiring the department to maintain a registry.
So can we hear from the department for their response on that issue, Ms. Ryan?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, the department has every intent to continue to maintain that database. It's well used by everyone in the state when researching contamination, so the department would have no issue changing it to a mandate to maintain that. We have every intention to. The other changes that Representative Josephson was proposing are more problematic for us. I think I'd have to look at the stuff you were reading, Mr. Josephson, Representative Josephson, but I believe it's associated with Superfunds. The issue with UECA is that it's the contamination or the remediation has already occurred. I mean, for the best public involvement, it would be much further upstream than the point when we're just noticing that there's use restrictions on the property. So I guess I don't know if this is the right vehicle for that concern, I guess is my point.
Well, Mr. Chairman, there seems to be broad agreement that the department would not object to changing the word may to shall on line 29, page 11. That's what I heard.
And so would you be, I think we are talking about amendment number 1 now. Would that be a withdrawal of amendment number 1 and the
conceptual amendment? Yes, I would withdraw amendment number 1.
Okay.
And offer that conceptual amendment, turning may to shall.
So you would offer conceptual amendment number 2?
Correct.
And that is to turn may to shall on page 29 on line 29 of page 11. And you're moving that motion?
I am. I'm so moved.
I will object for purposes of discussion. I think we've had discussion. I do think we've heard from a few people. We haven't heard from everybody, but I wanted to provide an opportunity for anybody else to provide a comment on trying to make that change. Do we have any other comments on the conceptual amendment, Representative Sullivan Leonard?
Thank you, through the chair, to Director Ryan. You had briefly mentioned a little bit about this amendment and the effects of its mandate. Could you provide a little bit more information on that, please?
Representative, through the chair, it is a database that we are currently maintaining that lists all the institutional controls. What the bill corrects is that it references that database from the deeds, so that an individual who isn't aware of our database will become aware of it if a deed lists there's contamination and they need to look at our database to find out what happened and where it is and what they need to do. So I guess my comment is that is an activity that the department is already currently doing and has every intention to continue to do. So changing it to a shall does not change how we operate.
Thank you, through the chair.
Sorry to follow up, sir.
So actually, we don't need this then. You're already following through the steps necessary to get information out to the general public through the database. So in essence, what I'm hearing you say is changing it from may to shall serves no purpose.
Representative to the chair, I mean, that will be, I think everyone gets to make their own decision on that, but it won't change what we do. That's correct.
Thank you. And we do have Jennifer Curry with Department of Law, and I'd like to actually ask Ms. Curry a question about that change. So, Ms. Curry, can you place your name and affiliation on the record, please?
Yes, this is Jennifer Curry. I work for the Alaska Department of Law in the Environmental Section.
Thank you. And Ms. Curry, are you prepared to respond to whether there are any issues with changing that permissive to a directive on page 11?
I am prepared to testify, and I would say that there is really no change. It requires the department to maintain the registry. But as Ms. Ryan indicated, they are already doing that, but it does not make a substantive change except to require it instead of have it be permissive.
And Ms. Curie, I guess I would have a follow-up. At this point, we don't have environmental covenants identified, so they would not be required to be put into a registry. I'll read the section right now, section 4604.350, called registry, says the department may maintain a registry that contains all environmental covenants and notices of activity and use limitation and any amendment or termination of those instruments. If we make that a shall, that means we are requesting that the department include all environmental covenants. If that's a may, are they required to include those environmental covenants in their database?
As a shall, they are required to include all of those documents within the database. With a may, they are not required to, but can.
And so at this point, we have the department statement, and I certainly believe them, but they have the ability to make the choice. They say that they will provide that information, but I do think, at least from my perspective, there may be some benefit into making the may a shall, and especially just in regard to the environmental covenants piece. So I'm just making that as a statement. So I do think that it might be worthwhile to make the amendment change. Any other questions from Ms. Curie or Ms. Ryan? Seeing none, we have Amendment 2 before us. Do we have any other comments or thoughts on Amendment Number 2, changing may to shall for registry? Seeing no others, do we have I had an objection. I will withdraw my objection. Are there any other objections to the amendment as offered by Representative Josephson? Seeing no other objections, the amendment to change line 29, the word may to shall, has been approved unanimously by the committee. That brings SB 64 before us. And do we have any additional committee discussion on SB 64? Seeing no additional discussion, can I entertain a motion, Representative Wool?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move SB 64, version 30-LS0446/J, as amended, be passed from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Thank you, Vice Chair Wool. Is there objection to the motion as stated? Seeing no objection, the motion passes. And Senate Bill 64 is moved from Labor and Commerce. We will take a brief at ease while we sign the paperwork. Thank you, Senator Machicki. Thank you. We are back on the record in House Labor and Commerce, 4:33 p.m. We will bring the Alaska State Home Building Association before us at this time. We had a presentation last year talking about the issue of residential building codes, and so we're going to bring that issue back before us. What I would like to do or request of the committee is that if the committee thinks this is an issue our committee should be engaged in, then to give me the authorization to request a committee bill, but I wanted to have an opportunity for a presentation to be made before the committee before I made that request. So we have Mr. Jim Dunlop, president of ASHBA, and if we can have Mr. Dunlop, see, actually, let me check my... please come forward, place your name, affiliation on the record, and provide us with a brief statement supporting your request.
Well, Chairman Keto, members of the House.
If you have a seat and speak into the microphone, we are recording.
House Labor and Commerce Committee, my name is Jim Dunlap, and I'm the 2018 president of the Alaska State Home Building Association. I'm here today with several of our members to talk about our desire for legislation introduced that would adopt the state residential building code. And as the president, I have formed a committee to put together the details of a bill that we feel beneficial for the state and its consumers. But at this time, what I'd like to do is turn this over to Mr. Jess Hall, who is a co-chair of our legislative committee, and we'll be playing an active role in whatever course of action that you and your committee would like to take in pursuing this.
Thank you, Mr. Dunlap, and that is perfectly fine. Mr. Hall, if you could place your name and affiliation on the record and begin your testimony, please.
Yes, I'm Jess Hall with the Alaska State Home Building Association.
Thank you.
From Palmer. Mr. Chairman, we asked to be here today, so I thank you for this opportunity. We wanted to be transparent in our efforts to advocate for the introduction of legislation to adopt a statewide residential building code. Currently, Alaska does not have a state residential code, but the state does have a variety of building codes adopted across multiple state agencies for different kinds of construction. Here's what we're asking you today. Please consider introducing a bill this session that will establish a state residential building code. And we've had many internal discussions amongst ourselves on what this bill should look like. And we appreciate the chance to share those thoughts with Chairman Keto and his office. And we have been in touch with the chairman and talked about this in the past. We now want to expand that conversation to legislators and the public. A good bill is a bill is a good way to put something on the table and let the discussions and the questions begin. We expect there will be many questions from you and your constituents, from municipal governments, state agencies, and certainly industry stakeholders. While we're not an industry that typically advocates for the growth of government and more regulations, we are a trade association that promotes best practices in residential construction and consumer protection. We sincerely believe a residential building code can be adopted in a manner that improves the quality of housing for consumers without being onerous and creating burdensome costs. A state residential building code will improve the quality of construction and housing stock across the state. On January 23rd, just a couple weeks ago, AHFC released their 2018 state housing assessment. It includes a lot of good information about the need to improve the quality of construction of housing, especially in the way of energy efficiency and the benefits that result. Here's what we would like the initial bill to say. We want to identify the residential code within the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. AHFC has been a fantastic partner with our industry for many years, and we have a good working and trusting relationship. HFC already requires inspections and code compliances for homes to qualify for their financing, so they are already familiar with codes and how they work and the benefit to everyone. We do not want to see enforcement measures and penalties at this time. Alaskan isn't ready for mandatory code compliance in every village and town. We simply want to see a code identified that can be a uniform template for housing construction. We believe the International Residential Code, or IRC, is the code that is most universally accepted and understood and is applicable for our industry and for housing in Alaska. We believe with these basic items is a good way to start the conversation. I don't want to take more of your time, but we are happy to try and answer questions.
Thank you.
Please know that there are people here in the room from our organization who are experts in building codes, and we'll be here in the Capitol all day tomorrow to talk to legislators individually and to try and answer any questions you have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hall. Thank you for your testimony. A question from Representative Knopp, Representative Stutes, and Representative Birch.
Thanks, gentlemen, Mr. Hall, Mr. Dunlap, for coming. So we briefly touched on this conversation last year in my office. So I guess my first question, Mr. Hall, will be is why? And I say why, and then I say who does it all apply to? Because, as you know, we have the numerous codes you mentioned. It used to be the ICBO, now the IRC, and NEA, UPC. I mean, so, and municipalities, different municipalities, organized cities, boroughs, have adopted codes. And so, I guess on a broader scheme, what are we hoping to accomplish? The disparity, help me out there. And then secondly, and I was aware of HFC's requirements for theirs, but I've never seen them. So if any members have anything from AHFC that would be beneficial to us to see what they have, it would be helpful.
Well, let's start with, I'll give you an example of why a statewide code would be beneficial. And you're right. And
Mr. Hall, if you could just identify who's speaking, because we have two male voices and it can be hard to pick up over the phone. So before you start, just say this is Jess Hall.
Oh, sorry. This is Jess Hall. To give you an example, in the Valley, we only have one place that has a building code, and that's the City of Palmer. City of Wasilla does not, and the borough does not. So if you build in any place, for the most part, in the Valley, there is no code to build from. Now, if you build and the house is financed by Alaska Housing, then you must follow the IRC because that's a requirement for them to finance the home. But if you go with a conventional financing, say Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, those kind of things, you don't have to build to a code. And there is a lot of that that takes place out where we are. It is a consumer problem that we hear about all the time from people that, and what happens typically is a lot of unlicensed builders, or we call owner builders, who want to build their own home but don't build it to a code. They just want to build their own house. Now, that's fine. But when they go to sell that house, the next buyer comes along, they think it's built to a code by a builder, which it wasn't, then move in and find out there's all kinds of problems, and quite often can be problems that can cause death. So how do we look at it? I, as a what I consider a professional builder, I always build my house to a code. I always have it inspected, irregardless of how it's being financed. And you know, I think that's the way it should be for the most part across the state. It is a consistent code that the builders can use. Sometimes when you build in different jurisdictions, say Anchorage, or you build in Palmer, and then you build someplace that doesn't have a code, they're building three different kinds of houses. Well, if we all built the same kind of structural building, that would make a lot more sense. It would be a little bit easier, but we'd also have a long-term housing stock that we know would meet certain requirements, including energy efficiency.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. And so I've got three, but before we move on to the next testifier, next question, I do want to let people know that are online for the Certified Real Estate Appraisers Real Estate Commission and the Board of Marital and Family Therapy. We are coming up against about quarter till five right now, so it's looking like we are not going to have enough time to get there. We will try and bring those bills up at a meeting soon. My staff will stay in touch with those engaged, and we appreciate your patience with us. So thank you. And I think the next question was Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair. Thank you. I noticed you said that this housing code will improve quality and improve housing stock. I can understand it improving quality, but I'm not getting the connection how it's going to improve the stock, the number of houses.
Jim Dunlap. Right now, back to the IRC and how this improves it, is that AHFC, any building that they finance, follows IRC. That is their minimum code. It is the minimum code in residential construction. The state of Alaska does not have a residential construction code. And in developing this, we have 14 municipalities through the state, different types of government that will, under definition, are municipalities. This is not impacting them at this time. But they fall within standards, again, because AHFC is there. AHFC is financing about 95% of rural Alaska and the projects going out there. So that has to follow AHFC. But where we have these gaps, they're loopholes. And so when the public goes out and buys a house from builders that are in land-used areas, and all the legitimate builders are using IRC out there already, they want AHFC financing for their consumers. It is the minimum standard. And the other thing is that when you have variable codes that you can build by, you have a quality problem in the sense that the subcontractors and the people working on the job are working under different codes, you might say, and different things. And when they go from one area to another to work, it creates a problem and challenge in the workmanship. This is strictly uniforming residential construction, and this is a gap in the state of Alaska. It doesn't exist. We don't have a residential code required across the state. It is the minimum standard. 37 other states already have statewide codes to eliminate this type of problem.
We'll follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair. To comply with these codes, do you have to have a certain certification to do that, as opposed to being just your average Joe builder?
No, but in certain areas, in municipal areas and Anchorage and other, you have to have a residential endorsement. That doesn't change whether you have that's a separate standard. But outside of that, you would just if the consumer is wishing to get financing, the fact that this falls under HFC, and a lot of the other financiers sell their notes to HFC, so it's pretty much already a standard in the state. This is just stipulating it statewide. It's not a great change there. But in direct answer to your question, what it amounts to is with this uniformity, everybody is learning how to build in the exact same manner and way, and it's not that we can do this in the Valley and we can't do this in Anchorage and we can do this someplace else. And in some cases, we need to drag the financial institutes a little further into this, but basically it's a standard that's coming. It's long past due.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the indulgence. So, of course, where I'm going with this is it doesn't sound like this would be putting any particular hardship on rural Alaska where they may not have accessibility for certain items or certain things. And that would be my question.
A lot of the housing that's built out in the bush is financed through Alaska Housing. Most of the projects and many of the corporations, the housing agencies out there work through HFC to do this. So, yes, they are, in those cases, probably 90% of the housing is built to the IRC standards. This would make everything else kind of fall into that line where you as a consumer or a home buyer would know that the house should have been built to these standards, whereas right now, even in the valley, you go buy a house outside of Palmer, you don't really know that. If you dig into it and you have enough, you know, do enough research to find out whether it was or not, but in many cases, it is not built to a code.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much for your testimony and presentation this afternoon. One of the concerns I have, and I'll just say I'm a fan of the home builders. I have served in local government in Fairbanks and in Anchorage, and frankly, I would probably pick any one of your members to build a home for me. I've always been deeply appreciative of the quality and caliber of work that is maintained by the organization. I have to say, though, as a resident and a representative in South Anchorage, deep in the municipal territory, you know, the grass seems to always be greener on the other side of the fence, you know. And you talk to builders in Anchorage, and you go, "My God, you know, if I could build a house out in the Matsu, you know, it'll save you $50,000." You know, I mean, just huge numbers. And I'm assuming that you by your reaction that you run into that once in a while. So it is kind of ironic to be here and listening to, you know, we want to bring this on as far as a statewide code. And I'm not sure I don't know that I disagree with that, but the absence of enforcement or penalties kind of begs the question, well, if you got a code out there or you put a law in place but you're not going to enforce it or impose any penalties, then, you know, what, you know, kind of what's the purpose? And I get the standard. But my question is, if somebody and I had I bought a property out in the Matsu on Big Lake and had an engineer's report and researched it, looked at it real close because it was built in the mid '60s, and but you know, at some point there's kind of a buyer beware deal or go hire a professional, maybe one of your members, to come and inspect this and tell me what's, you know, where it falls short. But I'm kind of struggling with putting a law into place or legislation and requirements into place without enforcement, without penalty, and kind of just hoping for the best. And I just wondered if you could comment on that through the chair.
Sure. This is Jess Hall again. Reason we kind of have that in there is we are pretty cognizant of the budgetary issues that we all face. Mm-hmm. And we don't want this to have negative consequences on a budget costing money to go out and do things. Maybe that will come down the road. We feel first we need a code, and then in the future we can address, you know, enforcement issues. But primarily the way it works in most of the places is we hire independent inspectors. In the city, you know, you go get the building permit, the cost of that includes those inspections. Well, in the valley we don't have that, so we hire a certified IRC inspector, and we pay them to come out and do those independent inspections. That will pretty much continue on the way it is. Now the question is, how do you do that out in really remote places where it's expensive, and what costs us, you know, $1,500 to do inspections might cost them $5,000 because the person has to buy plane tickets to go out there, you know, four or five times to do inspections. That would be burdensome. We recognize that. In Alaska Housing, I don't want to speak for them, but there are other ways that can be done, probably through video or pictures of the house as it's being built, that can be reviewed back by an inspector, and they can sign off on it that way. So those details, I think, need to be worked out by HFC. We're trying to just get that big umbrella part started, and then other things will have to come into place as, you know, details emerge on how to do that. So, yeah, we're on the overall umbrella right now, and I appreciate those questions. I think they're important, but we need to do step A, and then we'll do step B.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for the comments. I look forward to learning more.
Thank you, Representative Justice.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, my question was similar. I'm trying to think about our statutes and whether we could have essentially uncodified law that would just spell that out, that is, that we adopt the IRC, and also whether we would in fact just say that or write out the IRC in code, which must be very long. I tend to think we wouldn't do that. So we would have to consult with our statutory experts up the hill and see what they thought. But your belief is that a starting point is to have an adoption of the IRC and make it the sort of the template and then move on from there at some later date? Is that what I hear you saying?
Yes, for enforcement purposes. But, you know, as we mentioned before, HFC already does this in many parts of the states. You know, where I build, I comply to all the HFC. So they already have this envelope in place. It's just that it's not statewide and it's not any, you know, covered by anything except what they build. Now, if you do FHA, VA, or rural development financing, they require you to do the IRC inspections as well. But at least conventional financing out there, or people that build their own house out of pocket, and there's a fair amount of that that goes on around the state, those don't have inspections.
Okay, thank you. Representative Wolf?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think one of the questions is already answered, that the IRC code is the least stringent, but I was just wondering if there's different codes in, say, in the municipality of Anchorage, as that if it differs in IRC, is that going to be a conflict in codes?
This is Jim Dunlap. When you have an existing code, and this is when I mentioned the municipalities earlier, they have, when you have an existing code, what it amounts to, if you want to bring in a different code, that you need to make amendments to the code to make it equal to or greater than. You cannot come in with a lesser code. But what, so, and that's the reason we talk about the municipalities are already set up. They have a code. That might be the reason your house costs more money. Simpson likes you. We put a lot of steel in houses in Anchorage. But, you know, statewide, it's life safety for consumer. And the reality is if I built each of you a 1,200-foot house, one of them could cost $800 a month the heat, and the other one could cost $200 a month the heat. These lesser houses don't cost less money. Energy in this state is an enormous issue. And this minimum standard even needs amendments for energy down the road, but that's up to AHFC for what you're doing with it. But also when you look about this, when you start getting out of, like, say, in Wasilla, where you don't have a code, the expense to other state agencies, to municipalities, it becomes nil. You have now consolidated your code to one entity, AHFC. It already has an infrastructure. It's already in place. This allows the state to grow and have some standards, so we're not having this problem. It was in the front page of the paper just 3 days ago, the last few times, about the overcrowding and the quality and what have you. This is simply addressing this. This code will have amendments, and it will get more stringent in certain areas where it's required when you get into this density and things like this. And this is the reason many other states have done this, and it will be maybe not for the state itself when you get a fiscal note. It comes from AHFC. Other departments are going to holler because they wanted this, anything to do with it, but you don't have a residential code, and they lose it. But if regardless of where the money's coming from, if the state has a finite amount of money in it, and you turn around and you put this thing under one entity, as we're proposing, and it's a minimum code across the board, it's going to be the most cost-effective home building system that the state can possibly have. With that being said, back to your question, anytime you go into a place with an existing code, you have to meet or exceed that code. You cannot, if you come in with a lesser code, technically you're putting somebody in harm's way that wasn't there before, type of deal. And codes aren't allowed to be lesser once they're done. And that's the reason as a group, we work very diligently to make sure that codes aren't expanded unnecessarily making house unaffordable, because a code is something that's almost impossible to repeal. If you don't win that battle up front, you kind of have to let that go for the other battle type of deal to watch these things, and it's about keeping housing affordable. But a code is also about keeping it energy efficient, safe for the consumer, and that. And we have a unique situation in Alaska, and this is a single standard. And regardless of where it's coming from and what it's costing, there's not a more cost-effective, efficient system than what we're proposing. And it's going to have some bugs in it. And that's the reason that Jess goes way back, and I just wanted to make an introduction, because while I worked with this committee in putting it together, you have some of the finest minds in here who've worked for years with the codes, owners of private code companies in here, and builders and things like this. And this is something that needs to go through. But the consumer is it, the end product is paying more right now. They have less healthy houses than they should be, and there's a most cost-effective way to give them a safe, healthy house, and it's going to happen someday, and it needs to be done efficiently and cost-effectively. We're suffering greatly right now from unaffordable housing, and certain areas in the state, like Anchorage, they won't even use that word, affordable housing, anymore. And anyway, I'll stop.
So I think before we run out of members, we do have other meetings starting pretty soon. It is 5 o'clock. I guess I'd like to bring the issue before the committee for discussion on whether or not there's any interest in the committee moving forward with drafting a bill. That doesn't mean this issue goes away from our perspective. It means the issue comes back with some more background and specific bill language that we can work on. So, Representative Knopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, well, for me, if we were to decide to adopt a statewide code, I'd want to have the conversation about the mandates for municipalities that have not adopted a code, and also the mandate that homeowners would have to comply with the code, and then how would that be done? Would they just have to hire an independent building inspector? And if we were to pursue down that road, I'd rather see a more defined, I'd hate to leave it to this committee or those of us who are not in the building trades to write the code or define. I'd rather see more specifics come from the organization presented to us to forward. And I bring that up, Mr. Chairman, because there are some examples in what we do in building. So, you know, I mean, we've been building with wood foundations for eons, and we thought at one point they were going to go away. And today you still see it being done and still see them being financed. And in the old days, you know, when you did a monolithic pour, it was a 12-inch by 16-inch footings. And it's still that way today in a lot of areas don't have a code, but in the cities have, under the ICBO, I'll just use the old one, you know, they're a 20-inch footing now, deep, and then the insulation. So I guess my question would be for the organization, is that the type of practices you'd want to continue in everywhere we build, you know? And as you know, through the BEES initiatives and what the research at UAF has done through the cold climate, a lot of the building stuff in the northern region is completely different to what we would do in south central or southeast. So I guess my point is, Mr. Chairman, it requires a lot of conversation. I'd like to see the organization address and be a little bit more specific in what they'd like to see, because not only do they talk about adopting the, I'm going to say ICB, also when I remember, IRC, but to incorporate that, you should also incorporate the Uniform Plumbing Code or the NEA, everything else that you guys would like to see in this structure. So I think at this point, I wouldn't want to see us to bring it forward. I'd like to see the organization bring us something after more in-depth discussion.
And I think I'd like to respond briefly to that. I guess we can have more hearings. The challenge is the hearings stand on their own independent of any activity. If we do have a bill before us, we do have the opportunity to actually build a record on the issue. If we don't have the bill before us, then we're not building any record on the issue. Representative Justin.
Mr. Chair, I would support a draft. I mean, my sense of this is that nothing would pass this year, that this would be a building block, an education for the committee. We have to start some way. We might as well begin deliberating seeing where the consensus lies. Maybe 2019 is when the time is right, that sort of thing. But I also think that we've got an expert on the committee, and and we might as well take advantage of that.
Mr. Chairman, just briefly. What Representative Jolson said is true. The problem is, as you know, whatever we move this year will die at the end of this session. And so it gives this organization an opportunity to firm something up and to work the details for introduction to start a next session, and we got 2 years to work it, you know. A part of my train of thought, I just didn't mention it. So.
Any other comments, Representative Birch?
Yeah, I guess I would echo some of the concerns of my colleagues. I think from the standpoint of I sit in a highly regulated, very extensively inspected world in the municipality, and I guess before I having lived in Fairbanks for 25 years, I know that the Fairbanks city limits is probably about 30,000 people, and the Fairbanks North Star borough is about probably 90 to 100, and I know that sort of the large majority of the borough is outside of the of a building permit process. Same in the Mat-Su. So I think we've got some research to do before we start looking at pushing this out at least for my engagement. I would like to learn more. I like the idea of maybe a straw man coming forward or a proposal coming forward from the community, the housing authority folks that are interested in advancing this. I'd like to see something to work off of, but I don't know that I'm particularly prepared as a committee member to encourage that advancement.
And I guess Representative Birch, I would comment and say that in order to have a straw man, we need to have something drafted. In order to have something drafted, we need to actually make a request of legislative legal. And so if we are expecting them to bring language before us, they're not part of that process without having something concrete to work on. Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just kind of thinking here while I'm hearing the comments, is there a possibility maybe of a subcommittee where we could be working on this particular issue on the side?
If without an actual document to work on, we don't have anything to actually refer to subcommittee. There's no document before us, so I can refer. I don't believe I can refer an idea to a subcommittee.
They've had the IRC in other areas of the state. I don't know why we couldn't have a draft, maybe mirroring what Anchorage has, the municipality, to work from. I agree with what you're saying, but I feel like there's a big hurry up here where maybe we should kind of take a pause and have a subcommittee have a chance to look at it.
And I guess I don't know that I see an avenue for referring something to a subcommittee if we don't have something before the committee. But, Representative Stutes.
I think draft is the key word, and I don't have any opposition to having some sort of draft written up, and then we could have these builders back and answer some questions and make our notes. Mm-hmm. It's a working document, and it would be a document in progress, and I'm sure I agree with the representative from Kenai that it's very unlikely anything would happen this year, but it would certainly give us an opportunity to put our feet on the ground and see what direction we want to go.
Thank you. And I guess what I'd like to do, now we're running a little short on time, I'd like to try and get us moving forward, but if I can get a motion from Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move and ask unanimous consent that the House Labor and Commerce Committee authorized the chair to draft a bill establishing a statewide residential building code.
And I would just like to, I'll object for purposes, I'd just like to say that this doesn't mean that there's a consent to a building code. It just means consent to draft the bill, and then every member is available to vote or comment however they want to once we have a bill before us. So I'll remove my objection. Do we have any other objections to the motion? Seeing none, we will work on a bill draft, and we will bring it back before the committee in our normal process. With that, it is 5:08. We don't have time for anything else to come before the committee, so we will stand adjourned. Thank you.